All right, the next matter we have on calendar is docket number 52272, Ford versus State. Counsel, are you ready?
I am, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right. Did you want to reserve a little time?
I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I could.
Okay.
Chief Justice, Justices, Counsel for the State, may it please the Court. My name is David Westbrook. It's my honor to appear here today before the full court and to represent my client, Mr. Jerome Ford. We're here today because of secret words. The statute before you, pandering statute, is so vague and overbroad that it has allowed the Metropolitan Police Department Vice Squad to create a series of secret words which, if uttered by the right person, a person who fits their specific profile, an African-American male wearing certain clothes of a certain age, they result in a felony arrest.
And Mr. Westbrook, where did you get this argument, African-American males? Was there any investigation done on who was targeted, or is it just a supposition on your
part?
There
absolutely was. Thank you for asking that question. I'm not here on behalf of the Public Defender's Office today. This is a pro bono case, but I work for the Public Defender's Office, which means that we had access to hundreds of cases. We took an 18-month period, as reflected in my brief on page 18, I want to say. We took hundreds of cases to which we had access that we tried and we litigated, and we did a statistical analysis of the type of people that are actually arrested and charged with felony pandering in Clark County, Nevada. Our results were that 97%, everybody, save two people that was arrested during an 18-month period in Clark County, Nevada, was an African-American male. But it's not just the statistics that I'm relying on here today. In cross-examination, and keep in mind, I've included all of these transcripts. I know you're all familiar with the record. In cross-examinations, we asked every single officer that we had an opportunity to cross-examine. They all work in the same unit. They all have the same training. What do you look for when you're considering making a pandering arrest as a result of these sting operations? We were specifically told by Detective Benjamin, one of the many detectives who acts as a decoy in this case, who poses as a prostitute in the hopes of luring a potential pimp. And the word lure, by the way, is a term used by the detective on the stand. What do you look for? How do you know someone's a pimp? She said specifically, I knew it because of the way he dressed, urban wear, because of his race, and she named some other factors as well.
Okay.
The police department, the Metropolitan Vice Squad, specifically identifies race as a factor they look for when determining whether to make arrests and when actually looking for potential suspects. They list race as a factor. They don't say we look for African Americans specifically, but they list race as a factor, and race being a factor, 97% of their arrests are African Americans. And those are just our statistics. The state has pointed out at some point that, you know, our statistics aren't reliable because it doesn't include all the cases in Nevada or in Clark County, it just includes public defender cases. Officer Farron, another detective who acts as a decoy and who was the most active person in Vice Squad as a decoy, made the most arrests, she said that the number is 95%. 95% of the people that get arrested for these vice stings are African Americans. So there is no question, and the state has certainly never put forth one ounce of evidence to show that anybody but African Americans are being targeted. And certainly it's African Americans who are being arrested. What allows this to happen? The equal protection violations, which I detailed in my brief, are allowed to happen because the statute we are dealing with is incredibly overbroad and incredibly vague. I use the term secret words because that's exactly what they are. They're secret words, magic words that somehow juries have been told, if someone utters these secret words, they must be a member of the so-called pimp prostitute subculture. At trial in this case, and in fact, these same people are noticed in every case, there's two state experts, one of which is Detective Feiselman, who actually testified in the instant case. The identity of these secret words is given to the jury by Detective Feiselman. Words like dating. If you use the word date, like do you want to date, that doesn't actually mean dating to Detective Feiselman. It's a term of art that's only used by pimps, and anybody who uses that term of art is a pimp, and that's how you can tell. If you say to somebody, do you have a man, The word man doesn't mean boyfriend or husband. It means, do you have a pimp? I am a pimp, and I would like to employ you as my prostitute. Detective Feiselman testifies that that's what that means. That's not at all reality. In fact, I challenge Detective Feiselman's qualifications to speak as an expert in this case, or in any case, on pandering, because his testimony to the jury, and in fact the entire focus of the Clark County Vice Squad, is based on an outdated, outmoded, racially insensitive profile of what a pimp is, who the profile that has its genesis in the 60s and 70s and has not been updated since. Listed on the curriculum vitae for Detective Feiselman as the basis for his expertise are books, which I actually took the time to buy from Amazon and read, like The Lords of Hell. This is one of the things that's in his CV, which is before you in the record, as a basis for his expertise. The Shattering Story of a Negro Procurer and a Southern White Prostitute. This is what shapes the Vice Squad's training. A book that has the word Negro on the front. 1967 is the copyright date. The Art of Mackin is another book that he uses, which is not even about pimping and prostituting. It's about specifically how to sound like a pimp in order to impress loose women. That's what it's actually about. And that's on his curriculum vitae. Pimp by Iceberg Slim, another book on his curriculum vitae. These were said to form the basis for his expertise. What it actually does is it gives us an illustration of the fantasy world in which these police officers and district attorneys are living. They have decided that certain secret words uttered by certain people, not white people, on our chart.
Counsel, having said that, as the specifics in this case, didn't Mr. Ford ask the party if she understood what the pimp's role was in her line of work?
I believe that he did, yes.
And make some other references in terms of his history and what he did and what he could do for her?
Well, specifically, Your Honor, what Mr. Ford said was, the first thing he said was, baby, do you have a prince in your life? I could be your prince. That's prince, not pimp. That's closer to Snow White than it is to Iceberg Slim. After that, she engaged him in a conversation.
Well, counsel, the language of that particular industry is very interesting in terms of what is said and how is it communicated. But didn't he specifically talk to her about that industry and talk to her about protection and some other things? And I guess what I'm really interested in, though, is back to your initial argument as to the vagueness and overbroadness of the statute and whether or not the role of intent is featured in that statute.
Well, the intent question is very interesting, because if you go through the transcripts I provided, you'll see the state specifically arguing that this is not a specific intent statute, and then changing their mind in the brief and saying that it is a specific intent statute when they realized how incredibly fatal that first argument was.
Well, from your standpoint, how do they argue that in closing?
I'm sorry?
How do they argue that in closing?
Oh, they argued that Ford was specific. I mean, they argued specific intent in their closing. In this particular case. But you'll find that their arguments change depending on where they think the wind is blowing. That the same is true of their attempt argument. I mean, they cited a supplemental brief, which I didn't object to because it actually helps prove my point. They did some supplemental briefing in this case where the entire focus of the brief was citing California appellate cases, which are currently under review in the Supreme Court, I might add, saying that you don't need to complete the crime in order to have a pandering conviction, and there's no such thing as an attempt pandering. And yet, in this very case, they request an instruction on attempt pandering. So they're using that whole argument as both a sword and a shield. There's no such thing as an attempt, but we want an attempt instruction. To your point,
I thought you argued for the lesser included instruction on attempt.
Yeah, Mr. Goldstein argued for lesser included instruction. Yes, he did, in this case. Although, actually, Mr. Ford argued against it verbally, but his counsel argued for that, and that's what we're with. But it was the state's instruction that was proposed and the state's instruction that was accepted. So whether or not we argued for it, my point is,
the state originally charged him with attempt pandering. That was dismissed in the amended information. And then you get to trial settling jury instructions, and your client's lawyer asked for an attempt instruction, correct?
That's correct. And okay. So did the state. And it was the state's instruction that was actually used. My being, the state seems to be confused about whether attempt exists or not. And in essence, what happened here in this case is, if you follow their current line of reasoning, which is attempt equals completion, they requested an instruction that is an attempt of an attempt. And the answer to the question, is there such a thing as attempt pandering, is so much less important than the fact that the question exists. This is a vague and overbroad statute. These questions should not exist. The fact that they exist shows that the ordinary person can't possibly follow the statute properly. Back to the question.
Can you address the overbreadth issue and specifically the state's contention that inherent in the statute is a requirement of specific intent?
They say that inherently there's a specific intent requirement, but if you compare it to the statute that was recently overturned for being vague and overbroad
in
the Silver case, the language is the same. There's no specific intent element in that statute. There's none in this statute. The language is virtually identical. The only difference is, in that case, they say, in circumstances evincing an intent or something close to that. And in this case, the statute is completely silent. Frankly, the silence in this statute makes it less obvious and makes it more vague. A great difference between this statute and the California statute, by the way, is the fact that under the California statute, there's an exception when the pandering is allegedly of somebody who's already a prostitute. Because the California legislature, now their statute is flawed, don't get me wrong, but the California legislature recognizes that it's folly to suggest that you can actually commit a crime by encouraging someone to do something that they're already doing. I want to finish off Your Honor's last question. Mr. Ford said a lot of things, none of which constitute a crime. You can discuss prostitution even with someone you believe to be a prostitute. There was no corpus delicti in the case. What he was said was misreported to the jury through a transcript that was completely inaccurate and shouldn't have been entered. And he never once said...
Well, counsel, on that particular point, there was a transcript. Did they not play the audio?
They played it in court, Judge, and then the transcript went back to the jury in chambers. The audio did as well, but the audio was hard to listen to. I can almost guarantee, I wasn't in the room, that they looked at the transcript and they credited the transcript, even though it was wrong and it was arguable. It should never have gone back. Mr. Ford was talking about a supposedly legal business he had in New Jersey when he was talking to this detective. That would be the same thing as someone, remember, we are in a state where prostitution is legal in certain counties. Someone from the Bunny Ranch came down to Las Vegas and tried to get some more bunnies for the ranch, would probably ask exactly the same questions. Would that person be committing the crime of pandering? That'll reserve the rest of my time.
Could I ask a question before you sit down?
Sure.
Has the United States Supreme Court limited our consideration of hypotheticals on a facial challenge of overbreadth?
I don't think that in this case there's a limitation that we can place on the hypotheticals. Furthermore, we don't have to use hypotheticals at all. In showing a pattern of abuse of conduct, I included a multitude of actual physical cases that the Metropolitan Police Department has tried, things the officers have said, all of which fall under this milieu of training that they all received.
But does your client get to point to those?
He does.
Why?
He gets to point to them by way of first of all, this is a challenge. It's a facial challenge.
I got that.
Okay, it's not on the facts. So when you have a facial challenge, it's not fact specific. So he does get to point to those analogies. If something is overbroad and is restrictive of a constitutionally protected First Amendment right, such as hitting on a girl on the streets of Las Vegas, trying to get a date, then you don't have to relegate yourself to the facts at hand, nor do you have to relegate yourself to certain analogies or just talking about the facts of this case. It's a wide open canvas.
But this changed your position if this particular conduct was not deemed under the First Amendment as an illegal act.
Well, I believe that it was under the First Amendment illegal act.
I understand that, but I'm just querying. Would it change?
It wouldn't change anything, because I've given you many examples of actual cases, not just hypotheticals I dreamed up, where people have said nothing more than, hey, baby, you should come with me. I'll take good care of you. David Gaitherite said that. He was arrested and charged with a felony. That is all it takes. When I talk about magic words, secret words, that's what I mean. The police have been able to use this overbroad statute to make it mean anything they want. Maybe next week they'll decide that someone talking about rainbows and unicorns means that you're a pimp. That would have exactly as much meaning as using a book like Lords of Hell from 1967 and deciding that the language spoken in here means something today and is some kind of indication that you're part of some subculture, that the words are somehow your key to entrance into.
To follow up on Justice Hardesty's question, though, have you let your case in light of the recent Holder decision by the United States Supreme Court?
I have not looked at it in light of that case, Your Honor.
Because it impacts the, arguably impacts your ability to look to circumstances of people other than your client.
I can understand that, Judge, but in this case, what we're talking about is a vice squad that acts as a unit. We're talking about, I mean, these cases, I believe, were put before the court in this case via motion, so the court was able to consider everything that I've asked this court to consider as part of the record down below. Given that, it's as much a part of the record as anything that was said between Ford and the detective in this case. So even if that is the case, I believe that you can look beyond it, frankly, but even if that is the case, you know, I suspect that the analogies I use in here, which come from actual cases, using the actual witnesses that were in this case, are germane, even if it's true that that somehow restricts our ability to use hypotheticals. That said, we're talking about overbreadth and constitutional rights are involved, so you can go beyond the record. I think that's still good law, even in light of the new Supreme Court case.
Let me ask you one more question. I'm actually going to give you your 5 minutes because we've been peppering you with questions. Thank does you. The fact that this can be considered commercial speech affect your argument in any way?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Again, you know, we talked about, get back to the Bunny Ranch discussion. In this case, he was specifically claiming to have a business in New Jersey which employs women in some fashion or form. I don't think he ever said, you know, have sex for money or anything like that. He discussed the business that he believed that she was in. She was representing herself as a prostitute. He discussed her line of work, and then he talked about his line of work, which he said was a legitimate licensed business. He even went so far as to discuss the tax implications of working for his business. I know of no pimp that talks about tax implications or has a 401k or anything like that.
Didn't he say it's all about the money or something like that?
It is all about the money, is it not?
No.
I mean, people working at McDonald's, it's all about the money as well. Ultimately, what he was trying to accomplish there that night, I will submit to the court, might have been completely different than what he was saying. Maybe he wasn't looking for an employee. Maybe he was looking for 15 minutes in a cheap hotel. They have that too in Las Vegas. The point is, we've criminalized words, and the words are the only evidence in this case. That will have a chilling effect on our constitutional rights that can't be allowed to stand.
Thank you. But doesn't that undermine your corpus delicti argument?
I'm sorry, about the corpus. The corpus delicti argument, again, as I just stated, is just about words. And the state takes an interesting tactic. They say that the words are themselves the crime. So therefore, the words of the corpus. That brings up a really interesting concept that actually Justice of the Peace, Abby Silver, said when she was still Justice of the Peace. If the words themselves are not an admission by a party opponent, then they're hearsay. So how do you get them in, counsel? Excellent question. How do they get them in? How are they not hearsay? The state, again, has argued both sides of this. They'd argue that they're an admission by a party opponent, so that's why they're in. But if they're an admission, they can't possibly, under our case law, be corpus delicti. So they're not an admission. They're not they are corpus delicti. They're actually the crime itself. Well, if words are the crime, then how are they not hearsay? They're out-of-court statements used to prove the truth of the matter asserted. It's a catch-22 that's created when you start arguing that the words are the crime. And when you start arguing the words are the crime, the First Amendment starts to cry.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice, Associate Justices. My name is Michael Watson. I represent the state of Nevada and the respondent in this matter. I'd like to touch on the actual record in this case. I think a lot has been muddied up with the record here and the preliminary hearing transcripts and police reports that have been provided as part of the appendix in this case. And in fact, I believe the entire Volume 2 does not deal with this actual case. It deals with other cases that have not gone to trial and deals with other facts that aren't presented here. I find that troubling because it's really not part of the record of this case. And I would ask the court to focus on the record of this case. And appellant says that these were all argued below by motion, but they were not in this case. There was a one-page writ filed in this case that argued only impossibility with respect to the attempt pandering versus pandering. And that was all that was presented to the court below. Additionally, the numbers that have been provided with the study that done by the Public Defender's Office looking at their cases that they had, those were not requested in this case below, although repeatedly throughout the appellant's brief, he said that these numbers have not been given to us by the district courts, that this hasn't been ruled upon. Well, they were never requested in this case. So I don't even think that issue has been preserved in this case, and along with a number of the other issues. With that, I would like to address the Silvar case and the wording of that statute that this court actually took issue with. The wording that this court took issue with was in a manner and under the circumstances manifesting the purpose of. That is the area that this court quoted on two occasions and said that that opened up this statute, that made the statute so broad that the goal of the statute could not be reconciled with a specific intent. We don't have that language in the pandering statute that's at issue today. And I believe because of that, it restricts the language of that statute and makes the overbroad argument fail. The California Supreme Court in People v. Bradshaw, they point out how that was charged in that case as willfully, unlawfully, and feloniously, and that's how the state charged it in this case as a specific intent, and that's how it was argued to the jury in closing. And then later in People v. Deloitte, which is 207 California Appellate 3rd Division 323, the California appellate courts have actually looked at this issue and read specific intent into the statute there. In that case, they define specific intent as to their pandering statute as it being the intent of a person who is the object of the panderer to become a prostitute.
Counsel, are we allowed to read that into the statute, the intent element, if it's not there?
I believe so. I think the words themselves already infer that the specific intent is there. I don't see how you can have someone compelled or inveigled or enticed or persuaded, encouraged to become a prostitute without there being the intent for that to happen. And that's why the examples pointed out by the appellant in this matter fail. The intent isn't there on any of those cases. A rap artist just rapping about prostitution in general doesn't have that intent to actually turn a specific person out as a prostitute, employ them as a prostitute. The facts of the case here, the appellant came up to her and he was all business. It was about what he could provide to her, and she just had to keep working. Well, he knew what she was doing. He knew that she was a prostitute, or at least that's what his assumption was due to the fact that she was an undercover officer. And he just wanted her to keep working and provide him with all her money. Now, I realize he did say that he has this business. However, he claimed that the business was here in Nevada, that he was just starting up this yellowpages.com. But in the record, the appellant's counsel below argued that you can't have that business if you have any kind of felony convictions. Well, we know based upon the appellant's record, he did have those convictions. He couldn't have had the business in Nevada that he's claiming to have.
Counsel, is there anything in the legislative history that suggests that the legislature intended this to be a specific intent crime?
I'm not aware that there's anything in their legislative history that suggests that, but I think the entire statutory scheme as a whole suggests that.
And when would this court, decide when we should read specific intent into a criminal statute and when we shouldn't?
Well, I think at times when the wording of the statute itself lends itself to that, you know, going back to the Silvar case, that the language
we
of that
engage statute, in that kind of construction, are we not then becoming a super legislature in which we decide which statutes require specific intent and which ones don't?
I don't believe so, because I don't believe that each statute has to lay out the word specific intent. I don't believe the statutes as they exist today all specifically say this requires intent, this does not. And I don't think that the legislature needs to go back through all the statutes and do that. This court interprets the statutes, and when you're inferring something that appears to be there, I think that's within
the
court's.
Could we not say, for example, that at least with one part of the DUI statute? Could we not say with respect to at least one part of the DUI statute, intoxication being proven without the certain percentage of intoxication requires specific intent then?
I think that the DUI statute with specific intent, I'm not sure how that you would have to specifically intend to be intoxicated. Is that your question?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that could be read into that statute based on the way that statute's laid out. I think that's more of a general intent crime, because someone who drinks, they get to a certain level that they're no longer safe for the roads. I think that's more of a general intent question, and what we're trying to prevent there is the drunk driving in general. someone drinking to intoxication then to go to drive, I don't think that, one, that be a provable intent in most situations.
I guess it may not be the best of hypotheticals, but I'm trying to point out it's a concern of mine that it creates a slippery slope as to when the court invokes specific intent or some other standard.
I realize, I appreciate your concern, but I mean, I believe the court has done that in Silvar already.
So you'd say in this particular statute, we draw specific intent from the definition of the words used in Vile and so forth.
Correct. And in this case, despite the fact that specific intent wasn't in the statute, that was the way that, that the state read it. That's the way that it was argued and charged against
was
this
there
individual.
A jury instruction on specific intent?
It must, we may have just overlooked it. I you know, there wasn't a specific jury instruction with intent and what the intent had to be, although I believe it would be harmless error in this situation just based upon the fact that really the entire trial came down to arguing intent, the state's position being that the intent was to prostitute this woman and act as her pimp, and the appellant's position being that he was trying to recruit her as an escort for a legitimate escort service.
Counsel, why would it be harmless error if the jury was never told what intent was required?
Well, again, with us arguing that, I don't think that they could have come to their conclusion without possibly considering specific intent.
Doesn't it have to be a line? Or are we in a situation where we keep moving this to whatever seems appropriate at the time?
Well, I think that
it's criminal, it's not civil, so we have to have a specific line. You're on one side or you're on the other.
Well, I agree that you have to have that line with the statute itself, but as far as providing the exact jury instructions that went back, I think it can be cured by the fact that both parties argued the intent to the jury.
But based on what?
Just based on the arguments themselves. If both parties are arguing intent, the jury can't come to a conclusion without considering that.
But intent. We are governed by the black letter law, not the statement of counsel as to what the law is. Because from day to day, counsel might move, but the black letter law will remain the same. So how do we understand intent if it's not there?
Well, there were some instructions that involved intent, not a specific intent, not laying out what the intent, the specific intent definition that I'm asking this court to infer into the statute are, but there were some statutes that laid out the intent with regard to just defining intent for the jury. And again, that was what was argued in front of the jury.
Counsel, I mean, in following up on that, you cited a couple California cases. Have you looked at People versus King? That's 38 Cal 4617, 2006, California Supreme Court decision on this intent issue. Are you familiar with that at all?
I'm not.
Well, basically, it was a weapons statute, and there was no specific intent language, but the Supreme Court affirmed a conviction saying it was a jury question, and the jury could look to all the evidence to determine if the requisite intent was there. So I'm just wondering if you felt that had any application here to this case.
Well, I think it would fall under the application of whether or not there has to be that definite line. If there is a situation where the jury is presented with all the facts, presented with the arguments of both counsel that would follow a jury instruction if it had been provided, I think that would be enough to cure that. And again, I think it would be harmless error based on the facts and the arguments that were made in this case.
Do you have any comment on whether, and if so, to what extent, the two recent U.S. Supreme Court cases either advance or harm your cause with respect to vagueness and overbreadth? Or are you not familiar with them?
I'm not. I heard you, I believe you said Holden.
Holder and the Holder. Skilling case.
I'm not familiar with those cases. I do think, though, that with the vagueness issue, it's going to have to be void in all applications, and it's not here. When you apply the facts of this case, the statute does not fail for vagueness.
So you're saying he's within the core application of the statute, and he can't argue somebody else's, Julia Roberts and Richard Gere's,
exactly.
Pretty Woman.
Exactly. And again, listening to the recording and what was actually said there, his words were all business. He was about acting as a pimp and acting as a pimp for her, telling her what he could offer her and what he could provide her with as long as she kept working and provided him with that money. And I would also point out that Appellant counsel claims that there's no way that the jury could have considered this recording because the transcript went back. If you look at the minutes on the day of the deliberation, in those minutes, about 30 minutes after they went out for deliberation, they requested a laptop because the jury was unable to play the recording on the CD player that they had provided to them. And that laptop was provided, and it was over an hour later that they came back with their decision. So to say that obviously they didn't listen to it is a stretch, and I think it's belied by the record. If any conclusion can be drawn, it's that they did listen to the recording before coming back with their decision. So I don't think it was an error, certainly not a manifest abuse to admit the transcript, which was made clear by all parties and the court that it was simply an aid and that the jury needed to consider the actual words of the recording. I would also touch on the corpus delicti. The words do constitute this crime, and I think the issue with corpus delicti and what's being missed here is that corpus delicti deals with a confession after the fact. This isn't a situation where the appellant went into the police station the next day, said, you know what, last night I was trying to act as a pimp. I found a prostitute on the street. I told her this. I could provide her with this. I could provide her with that if she would just work and do this for me and provide me with the money. This is what I would do for her, and now arrest me. This isn't that situation. The situation we have here are the words actually being spoken to the officer at the time. It's really no different than a soliciting prostitution case or a threats on a public officer case, where those words themselves are what is being presented and and constitute the crime themselves. To say that you can't have only words constitute a crime and you have to have another act would actually implicate many more statutes than just this one. And I think it's a stretch and doesn't really follow the reasoning behind corpus delicti. I'd also like to point out that with Detective Feiselman's expert testimony and his curriculum vitae, he does cite to those books and movies on his curriculum vitae, but he also cites to and testified to the fact that he was nearly 6 years on Vice as a detective, that he had over 150 hours of training in prostitution-specific training that he received through the FBI and U.S. attorneys and other agencies. He now teaches for the FBI and U.S. attorneys and other agencies, and that he, during those 6 years, focused on child pandering and prostitution cases and spent his entire time on Vice dealing with pandering and prostitution, learning this language, learning this subculture. It's not a situation where he just read three books, watched a couple movies, and then came in and testified. That's not what was at issue here with the expert witness testimony.
Don't you think he ought to take those books off his resume, though?
It's probably... I mean, they are things that he has read.
Mention the word Negro in a book. I mean, come on. This is 2010.
I realize that, but you know, we still today read literature that in the past at that time was applied at that time was not offensive. I agree that does seem offensive today by today's standards, but just because it says that on the cover doesn't mean that those standards and what's incurred in that book doesn't affect what happens today and the language that we hear today and how that works and how it's formed that pimp and prostitute subculture. Because what a lot of that culture comes down to is the money, and it's also the control of these prostitutes and the control over these women. And that's what makes these operations, these undercover operations, an important tool for law enforcement. Because when they're dealing with these women that have such control over them by the pimps, and the pimps use the words and they use their actions to get control over them, it's important that we be able to find a way to prosecute them, because it's difficult to do when you have a victim who is under complete control. It's sort of similar to the battery domestic violence issues, where that person is under the control of the batterer. It's the same situation, and this we've been able to use these operations in order to prosecute these men that are going out and using the words and trying to manipulate these women into that lifestyle.
All right. Colleagues, any other questions?
I have one more.
All right.
If you credit your opposing colleague's reading of this statute, which is that it's very close to Silvar because encourages, persuades, induces are words that are directed to the target.
Correct.
And what they do in response to his or her words, not to his intent. So you say the statute doesn't have an intent. That's his argument, that it's very close to the Silvar statute.
Correct.
Do you get any help for your argument? You didn't cite it, but NRS 193-190, which is the general criminal intent statute that says in every crime or public offense there must exist a union or joint operation of act and intention. Does that statute apply in any way to this statute or argument?
I believe so, because I believe the examples that have been listed, such as the rap artist or Julia Roberts, lack intent completely, whether specific or generally. There's no mens rea at all whatsoever.
And if we were going to apply that statute, what then saves us from the slippery slope that Justice Hardesty was describing of which statutes do you import this intent into? And what about the malum and prohibitum statutes?
Again, I think it has to deal with the wording of the statute itself. The wording of the statute is going to have to control over whether it's a specific intent and general intent and what those words mean. I think in this case, with the encouraging, inveigling, enticing, persuading, I don't see how you get past that being a specific intent or any other type of intent, because you have to have that intent that person become a prostitute or remain a prostitute. There's really no other way to do it. Otherwise, it's just general advocacy of prostitution. I mean, if someone's outside chanting that prostitution is great right now, they're not falling afoul of the statute. It's when they walk up to a particular person and then try to encourage that person to go into that crime, into that lifestyle, which is a crime, and commit that crime. That's when it runs afoul of the statute.
Any other questions? All right, thank you.
Times are tough. It's very difficult to get a job in this market. I'd like to send a message to everybody graduating from Nevada law schools this year. Give up your search for a legal job and become a prostitute. My intent in saying this is for you to become prostitutes. I think that you'll have more flexible hours and you'll find greater satisfaction. Have I just violated the pandering statute? If I have, by all means, come and arrest me. I'll be at 309 South 3rd Street. If
counsel,
I have not,
is that sexual conduct for a fee?
Sexual conduct for a fee, yes.
That you're describing?
I believe that that's what they should do. I believe it's a better career move.
No, I'm asking you this illustration you put forth to us in this last sentence. Looking at the definitions of 201, 295, they talk about what that is. And you've just given us something that, at least to my ear, clanked. So I'm asking you, does it fit?
I'm not sure if it fits. Honestly, I don't know if I've just violated the pandering statute or not, which is why I've made a vagueness challenge to it. And in listening to what the state just said on argument, when I say that they tend to switch...
Counsel, 201, 295, sub 3, prostitute, means a male or female person who, for a fee, engages in sexual intercourse or a genital contact or any touching of the sexual organs or other intimate parts of a person for the purpose of arousing or gratifying the sexual desire of either person. For prostitution means engaging in sexual conduct for a fee. Now, is that what you just told us or not?
Yes, it is. But I wasn't very specific, just like the statute isn't very specific. I mean, the pandering statute doesn't include that definition at all. It doesn't include that definition anywhere, and nothing that Mr.
Ford graduating from law school reflect that in the definition?
I'm sorry?
That you just put forth.
Well, I said that to be specific.
I understand what you said. That's why I asked the question.
Yeah.
Since you made the argument to us.
Well, Your Honor, I wasn't making the argument in an
Make your argument, then.
The argument is this. The state of Nevada is trying to read specific intent into this when it doesn't exist. I'm glad the DUI statute was brought up because it allowed opposing counsel to say that the DUI statute, which for the record does have the words willfully, unlawfully, and feloniously in it, is a general intent crime. That's what they just argued. That's what my opposing counsel just argued. It's a general intent crime, despite the fact that it has the words willfully, unlawfully, and feloniously in it. The pandering statute, I don't believe it actually has the words willfully, unlawfully, and feloniously in it. I know that when the state charges it, from time to time, they put those words in there, but they do not exist in the statute. So the very argument that they're trying to ask you to buy, which is this body has to be a legislative body, and read into the statute things that simply are not there, they contradict when they say that the DUI statute is general intent. The DUI statute has the words in it, and they still say it's general intent. This statute does not. Furthermore, there's no way to differentiate people who are violating the pandering statute versus people who are violating the misdemeanor solicitation of a prostitute statute, which is very specific. The solicitation statute is very specific. It would always survive a vagueness and overbreadth challenge because of the language, Your Honor, that you just read. This one is nonspecific. Is somebody who goes out as a John and solicits a prostitute,
is he not also violating the pandering statute? And how do you differentiate those that will be charged as felons and those who will be charged as misdemeanors? How do you do it? The fact that I can't tell you how you would do it, except possibly by the color of their skin, which is what the statistics are telling me, the only statistics available in this case, the actual arrest statistics. How else do you differentiate it? Do words coming from one person of one skin color mean one thing, and do words coming from another person of another skin color mean something else, even though they're the same words? When I say the word date, what do I mean? When Mr. Ford says the word date, what does he mean? This Art of Mackin book that was in Detective Feiselman's CV specifically addresses the word, do you have a man? And it specifically identifies it as a bad pickup line used by people who are trying to have game or to be Mac daddies or to pretend like they're pimps. Judge Mosley, I think, said it best when he said, this is all puffery. How do you distinguish what these people are saying in these cases with simply puffing, with pretending to be something you're not, in the hopes of hooking up with a woman? And the fact is, when you do as the state is asking you to do, criminalize words, then you do infringe on the rights of everybody to say what they want. These are legal things that are being said. There is no criminal intent in the statute. And to uphold this statute would be incredibly dangerous. And it would have a freezing effect on all of our constitutional rights. Thank you for your time.
All right. Colleagues, any questions? All right. Counsel, thank you for your arguments and your briefs today. And this matter will stand submitted. And the court will stand in recess until tomorrow morning.